Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, how to measure the collapse of the economy and what the government can do about it. Unemployment is skyrocketing. The global economy is turning inward, and very few industries remain untouched as demand grinds to a halt. Every week seems to bring a shocking new data point. The latest, yesterday, the price of oil fell below zero, a sign of just how deep the repercussions of this pandemic are and how long they may last. Neil Irwin is a senior economics correspondent for the New York Times. He says understanding exactly what's going on is key to forming the right response. I spoke with him Tuesday morning. Neil Irwin, let's start with the oil market. Tell us what's happening there with oil in negative territory.
So there are two stories here, and one involves the fundamentals of oil and the economy, and the other involves some really weird stuff happening in financial markets. I'll start on the real side of things. Oil producers, they can't turn on a dime, right? When you have pumps running and producing oil, it's a big deal to shut them down. But in the last 6 weeks, 2 months, demand for oil has collapsed. Planes aren't flying, cars aren't driving, there's less need for oil. And it just takes time for the oil producers to respond to that lack of demand by shutting down production. So right now there's a glut of oil in the world. Prices have fallen a lot. That's the kind of fundamental real story. Then there's what happens in oil futures markets. And when reporters like me or economists talk about the price of oil, what we usually cite is actually the futures contract for a barrel of oil a month out. And in those markets, It's kind of abstract. It's kind of a numbers on a computer screen, but eventually it gets converted into the actual oil, black viscous fluid. And because of this, what's happening on the real side of the economy, there's a shortage of storage space in Cushing, Oklahoma, where these contracts were settled. And so there's actually nowhere to put all the oil that's out there. And so you're actually having to, instead of paying money to buy oil, you get paid to take it because there's a shortage of places to put it. And that's how we ended up with this very bizarre situation of a negative futures price for oil yesterday.
So what could that mean for the economy at large?
So normally, for years and years, I had always thought of when oil prices are down, that's good for the U.S. economy, right? You cheaper gas, heat your house for less, electricity prices go down, that's all good. In the last several years, that's kind of been flipped on its head. As the United States has become a bigger producer of energy, the production side of oil and energy is a much bigger deal than it used to be. And so now that we're at, wherever oil prices settle, somewhere around $20 a barrel, $30, whatever it ends up being, that implies that a lot of oil producers and energy producers throughout the oil patch in America, throughout the central United States, are no longer going to be viable, and they'll have to shut down. So there's going to be less capital investment, less investment in equipment. There's going to be bankruptcies, layoffs, restructurings. A lot of bad stuff's going to happen, assuming oil prices stay this low.
So you write that this could be a cautionary deflationary signal.
That's right. So inflation, of course, is when prices are rising, when the economy is overheating. Deflation is the opposite. And that's what we seem to be having. I know, people look at a few things that are where there's shortages, there's not enough face masks, there's not enough toilet paper, not enough medical equipment. And those supply shortages are real. But the overall story in the U.S. economy right now is the opposite of that. There's a glut of everything. There's a glut of oil. There's a glut of corn and other agricultural products. There's a glut of services. So empty hotel rooms, empty airplanes, empty stadiums. All of those things speak to an economy that's has a lot of idle resources where prices are going to be falling in the months and years ahead. And that's a very risky situation to be in.
But Neil, should the economy turn around as we hope it will in months to come, wouldn't that mean it takes a while to catch up, but in the long run, with all that oil available, and the president is talking about putting that oil into the reserves, all that oil could be a benefit, could it not?
Sure. Look, this productive capacity to drill for oil is not going away. It's not like, you know, when they shut down a drill that it, you know, ceases to exist. So if the economic situation changes, you know, we can have a rebound. There's no question about it. Same with airplanes, right? You know, the airlines are currently using runways as a parking lot for airplanes. Airplanes are not flying. They're not doing anything. Those airplanes don't go away. And so if people get comfortable traveling again, the airlines can come back to full capacity relatively quickly. There are a lot of unemployed workers right now. They would love to be at work. They would love to be back on the job. That said, it's hard to flip the economy on and off like this. And, you know, the idea that a restaurant, for example, that's not operating right now and may or may not survive this at all, can just go back to full speed overnight is, I think, really not how things are likely to work. So I don't want to be too pessimistic or too optimistic, right? On the one hand, as we get more comfortable with whatever the health protocols end up being, there is room to have a real rebound and have the economy feel a lot better. On the other, you know, you can't just rip up all of these kind of economic relationships and repair them instantly.
What you're saying is it's going to take a long time.
I really think so. Even if they discovered a vaccine that was, you know, available in months, which is not, you know, not, seems like it's going to be a lot longer than that. I do believe it would take some meaningful time for these economic problems to heal.
Now, let's talk about the job losses. They're at a level we haven't seen since the Great Depression. How are you viewing that? Is that another issue it's going to take years to repair?
So I think the question is, to what degree can we make sure this is short-term unemployment and does not become long-term unemployment? You know, one thing that happened in the 2008 crisis is a lot of layoffs, tons of industries had to cut jobs, lots of people lost their jobs. That's bad enough. But then there was a very slow recovery after that. So people who lost their jobs might have stayed unemployed for a year, 2 years, 5 years. And what happens when people are out of the labor force or unemployed for long periods of time is their connection to the world of work diminishes, it atrophies. So their skills aren't up to date. Their professional network dissipates. You know, the longer you're out of work, the harder it is to get back into work. And you know, if this really does take years to play out, that's the great risk, is that, you know, people who were perfectly good at their jobs, who were working hard 6 weeks ago, 2 months ago, are, you know, 3 years from now, still having trouble getting back into the workforce. And that's the scenario in which this does very lasting damage to the U.S. economy. We want to keep that from happening.
What about the assistance that's going not only to individuals, but to businesses, large and small, from the federal government? How much is that actually helping?
It seems to be helping, but there's a difference between helping and solving the problem, right? The initial payroll protection plan and the stimulus bill that passed in March was, you know, $300 billion, which sounds like a lot of money, but when you're trying to use it to cover the payroll of thousands and thousands of companies, that money does not last very long. It basically didn't even last a week. I think the risk is that even if the government's doing some of the right things, is there the follow-through? Is there the understanding that this is not just a one-month problem, something that's going to take many months to play out, and in which we actually want the government to backstop people's wages? You know, some of the things that apply in a normal time don't really apply here. So normally with unemployment insurance, for example, you worry that if those benefits are too generous, then people are going to, you know, not really look for a job and be comfortable, you know, sitting around the house. Well, right now we want people sitting around the house. We want them to go back to businesses when they're able to open safely in ways that are good for public health. And so, you know, I think there are different dynamics, but I think we're already starting to see from Congress a little bit of bailout fatigue and a little sense of, you know, we've already spent these trillions of dollars, we can't do anymore, when this crisis is really far, far from over.
You know, earlier you mentioned restaurants, and I was somewhat taken aback reading this morning in the Times that restaurants like Shake Shack and Ruth's Chris Steakhouse and Potbelly are receiving these huge amounts, and small restaurants, they ran out of money. So they didn't get any. How does the allocation happen? Is that at the top? Is that in the middle? How does that happen?
So the program that we're talking about, the Paycheck Protection Program that was in the stimulus, the way it worked is you had to work through your bank. So you go to the bank that you do business with and do an application. They then receive these loans through the Small Business Administration. The bank takes a small fee. It's really the government providing the money. And then if you've hit the qualifications, you keep paying your employees, you're paying your rent and utilities, you get that loan forgiven. So it's really not a loan. It's really a grant if you follow the rules and do it right. The problem with that system is it was, first of all, it was way too small. It was, you know, again, it ran out within a few days. And so it tended to favor the companies that had good lawyers, good accountants, good relationships with their bank, right? So if you're Shake Shack, a publicly traded company with however many locations, you have a CFO and you have a deep relationship with your bank and good accountants and all that sort of thing, you were able to be first in line and get that loan. Whereas if you're the little restaurant on the corner that has less relationship with your bank, less sophisticated on some of the financial stuff, by the time you could even get the form filled out, the money was gone. Personally, I don't begrudge these big restaurant chains from participating in these things. They have a lot of employees too, and they saw the same 90% drop in revenue that smaller restaurants did. But the problem is when these programs aren't scaled big enough, there's kind of a prioritization that happens based on how good a relationship you have with your bank or how big and sophisticated you are. That's what's problematic. So if this program was big enough, it could be a non-issue because everybody could benefit. But the way it's actually structured, these big sophisticated companies really won. I will say, just to be clear, Shake Shack gave back the money. They said,
yeah, they decided to give back the $10 million. Does the same hold true for example, clothing stores like Neiman Marcus versus a small dress shop in a shopping mall? I mean, is the same issue at work? You've got to have the lawyers, you've got to have the big money to even get your foot in the door.
I think it does. I think there's an interesting question here of, the approach the U.S. government has taken is for smaller companies, there's this payroll forgiveness. And then for the very big companies like the airlines, there is kind of specialized deals that are bailouts. What happens for companies in the middle, I think, is a really big open question. First of all, you have to make sure there's enough money for those little guys to stay open. There currently isn't, but on Capitol Hill, they're negotiating that right now. Then there's the middle market companies, companies with a few hundred employees, maybe a few thousand. They're not getting a special bailout like the airlines. They're not, small companies that the PPP is aimed at, but they employ a lot of people. And, one thing I think we're learning about this crisis is we initially thought of it as it affects, hotels, restaurants, airlines, a few things in tourism. We're seeing that those impacts are much broader. We're seeing it with oil companies right now. We're seeing it with, how many media companies are in trouble. How many law firms are having less business because there's less going on? I mean, it's kind of an endless list, which is what's really worrying.
So you recently wrote that we actually don't even have the tools to understand exactly what's happening to our economy right now. What do you mean by that?
Usually economic data is very useful for understanding if the economy is growing or shrinking and whether it's doing really well or okay or not so good. And, that's what we have. That's our kind of our temperature gauges for the economy. We have the jobs report, we have the unemployment rate, we have GDP numbers, we have industrial, entire list of economic data. This crisis is so strange and unusual and profound that it's really going to mess up a lot of that data in all kinds of screwy ways. I mean, I'll just mention a couple of them. The survey response rates that the unemployment rate is based off of have plummeted. Same with the job growth numbers. Normally the survey takers go to people's houses to survey them. Well, right now for safety, they don't do that. They're trying to get people on the phone. So the survey rate response rate went down a lot. If a company is closed up entirely, you can't get the HR person on the phone to tell you how many employees they have. And So just the collection of the data has gotten harder. Even things like the adjustments they do to account for companies being formed and destroyed or going out of business are going to be out of whack. So I think we have to look at data over the next few months with all these weird caveats in mind. We know it's really bad, right? We know the basic direction of things, but understanding exactly how bad things are, when they're starting to turn around, that'll be much trickier to judge.
So how does the government then craft its own response if it doesn't have the data it needs?
I think the approach is you err on the side of trying to help people in trouble. Another example of one of these problems is the unemployment insurance claims. So every week, every Thursday morning, we get a new number of the previous week, how many people filed new claims for unemployment insurance benefits. Well, think of all the weird ways those have changed in the last few weeks. They've been astronomical numbers, 10 times their previous all-time high. But they probably would have been even higher, except for all these states have, kind of rickety old systems. And so there was backlogs and people couldn't actually file benefits because the computers were not up to speed. That implies we're going to have even more of those claims in the future. You also have situations where like the unemployment benefits are enhanced by this legislation. So maybe that makes more people inclined to file for benefits than would have been in a previous recession. There are all these weird changes, but I think understanding, even if we don't know the exact calibration, we know it's really bad, and trying to help people get through this period is the primary goal.
A quick break. More of my conversation with Neil Irwin when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here is the rest of my conversation with Neil Irwin. He's senior economics correspondent for the New York Times, where he writes the Upshot column. Many people worry that the country is falling into a depression. You wrote a column in March about what the country needs to do to keep from falling into depression. What are those things?
The first step is to make sure that people can get through this period without ending up in a devastating situation, right? So if people are, not just losing their jobs, but losing their livelihood, the ability to feed themselves, that's how you can have long-lasting effects. If people are in school, you want them to be able to stay in school. People are, you don't want people to starve. You don't want people to have a health crisis that's not necessary because of, lack of help. So that's where unemployment insurance benefits, some of these plans to help companies keep people on the payrolls, that's where those come in. That's helping people get through this next few months. It's traumatic. It's hard for everybody, but you want to come out on the other side, able to go back to work in a physical sense, in a mental sense, and ready to go back to the job. Next, you need a job to go back to. So we need to make sure that companies that are viable and have a future can ride this out and be ready to rehire and pull people back in to work when we get out of this. So that's where some of these bailouts come in. I know a lot of people don't like giving money to businesses and, these big businesses, they're bad. I think people underestimate how bad it would be if there was a wave of, thousands of bankruptcies in every major industry of every major company all at once. I think that would leave the capacity for companies to have a job for people to go back to in much worse spots whenever we come out of the public health crisis. And finally, there's making sure the financial system doesn't break apart. For a while there, in March especially, there were some real strains in the financial system that could have exploded the way the 2008 crisis did.
Such as?
A breakdown in trading of treasury bonds. So this is the bedrock asset of the global financial system, and that market went completely haywire. If that were to go unchecked, and the Federal Reserve's done a lot to keep that in check, but if it were to spiral out of control. That's how you could have the combination of a public health crisis and a financial crisis at once. And we saw how bad a financial crisis alone can be back in 2008. I think there's progress on that. There's still some areas of worry, right? So think about all the people not paying their mortgage right now because they don't have an income coming in. If that causes losses in the banking system, losses in mortgage-backed securities, that could be a repeat of 2008. Think about all the landlords, commercial landlords who aren't getting rent checks right now, who owe debts to their creditors. There are still some real worries out there in how the financial system survives. I think the Fed's done a lot. They can do more to try and keep the financial system functioning. If we do all that, we can end up in a fine spot in a couple of years. But it's a lot of moving pieces and a lot to do to make it happen.
NPR reported yesterday that their top executives are taking pay cuts. They did not talk about layoffs. I think this is happening in universities, in businesses around the country. What about the New York Times? Are there any announcements of pay cuts or layoffs?
Not that they told me about, but I would not be the first person on the list. I do think this is, there, again, I kind of referenced this earlier. I think there are a lot of different types of companies that are not necessarily directly impacted by this. They're not restaurants, they're not airlines, but are going to see major impacts. You mentioned, higher ed is certainly one sector. Media, we've already seen, especially in advertising-driven media companies, a lot of problems. This is not going to be a nice, simple, easy, contained problem. This is going to affect virtually every industry you can think of, and that's part of what makes it scary.
What about the Fed? What does the Fed need to be doing right now?
So they've done a lot already. They have essentially said what we're ready to do is to create these, they're called special purpose vehicles, with some money from the Treasury and a lot of money from the Fed, and use that money to push cash into all these different credit markets. So they're these special vehicles. They'll buy up corporate bonds to pump money into the corporate sector. They'll buy up municipal bonds to help state and local governments. They'll buy mortgage-backed securities. They'll prop up all kinds of different parts of the credit markets. So what the Fed can't do is just write checks that give you money. They can make loans. And so in sectors where lending is what they need, where companies need the liquidity to get through this difficult time.
Small businesses.
The Fed is less focused on small. They have what's called the Main Street Lending Facility that is aimed a little more at mid-sized businesses that I mentioned earlier. Kind of the PPP is aimed at the small guys, the Main Street Lending Program from the Fed. I think the challenge, and I was kind of alluding to this earlier, is, all right, so loans are great. And if this is only a couple of months, loans can get you through. On the other hand, if this is going to be many, many months, maybe a loan isn't enough. Maybe you actually need grants. And so the Fed is not really set up to do that. So how this shakes out for companies that are in bigger trouble than just needing an emergency loan, I think is something we don't know the answer to. That said, they've been very aggressive. The Fed, think about all the stuff they did over 18 months back in 2008. They crammed all that into basically 3 weeks in March of 2020. The chair, Jerome Powell, Jay Powell, very savvy guy. He understands kind of financial markets, how business works. They've been aggressive. Will it be enough? We don't know.
So what about global markets and U.S. participation in global markets?
I mean, this is a global crisis. I think, there's no question that virtually every country on earth is dealing with some impact of this, some worse than others, of course. But and I think it would be a different form of globalization in the future than we've seen in the past. I think countries are going to look inward, focus on kind of resilience, making sure that they have all the things domestically that they really need. I think this situation where, the U.S. desperately needs PPE, protective equipment and medical equipment and have to import a lot of it from China is raising a lot of alarm bells. Like how is it that our entire pharmaceutical supply chain is offshored, is in China? How is it that we aren't able to make enough, masks and protective gear for our healthcare employees? So I think, especially in medical and pharmaceuticals, you're going to see a ton of focus on reshoring and making sure we have domestic capacity. and then multiply that by every country on earth and every good that seems really important, I think countries are going to be looking inward for a long time to come after this crisis.
And the last time this kind of deglobalization, if you will, took place, you're right, was after the 1918 flu pandemic. So what happened then?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to disentangle what happened with the 1918 flu from World War I. But if you go back before World War I to, 1910, especially within Europe, it was a very, you could travel freely. Countries, everybody parked their money in London. Everybody traded goods freely between countries in Europe. And that, of course, all fell apart first with World War I, then with the 1918 pandemic. And the era of the 20s, 30s through World War II was a period of countries looking inward and deglobalization. I think it's completely plausible that that's the kind of era we're entering. I caution that everything about this has been kind of unpredictable. I could never have 2 months ago predicted we'd end up here. So I am reluctant to be too confident in any kind of predictions, but there's just no way something this big can happen without pervasive, world historical effects.
And what about the stock market? What's going on with the stock market?
Yeah, it's funny. It's down, but it's not down nearly as much as you would expect given the scale of this crisis. I haven't checked the numbers today, but last I looked, we were only down about 14% for the year on the S&P. If you had said we're entering a global depression potentially, but stocks will only be down 14%, it'd seem crazy. A few things going on. I think one is that all this work the Fed has done to pump money into the financial system, that is particularly beneficial to the kinds of large companies that are heavily represented in the stock indexes. They have access to bond markets. They have the balance sheets and the access to liquidity to kind of ride this out. They may even, some of them end up stronger out of this, right? If you're Walmart, you're probably going to see a lot of smaller retailers go under. You might actually have a stronger competitive position coming out of this than you had going in. But that said, to me, these numbers don't make sense. I really, tend to, I'm reluctant to ever pretend to be a stock picker. If I were, I'd probably make a lot more money at a hedge fund. But given the scale of what we're seeing in the real economy and how bad this is, does not seem to align with the relatively moderate drop we've seen in the stock market, to be honest.
You're saying that it really ought to be a bigger drop that's showing up rather than the 14%.
I have a hard time imagining that we don't have another leg down. Again, take that with a grain of salt. trying to predict markets is a fool's game, so I'm reluctant to make any kind of prediction. But I just look at the economic data. I look at the anecdotal things we're hearing from companies, and it's just hard for me to see that this bounces back and ends up being a short-lived downturn as opposed to something more prolonged and more dangerous.
Finally, Neil, the president is pushing to reopen the country. He has encouraged protesters to go out there and demand that their cities and states reopen. A number of governors have been targeted. He says he, on the one hand, would like to see them open businesses slowly to see what impact this could have. Does this mean small businesses? Does this mean restaurants? What does it mean?
It's a very strange thing to have the president both kind of wants the country to get back to business and wants the economy to not suffer. However, also kind of doesn't want to take responsibility for the real details that come into play doing this. And doesn't really have that power anyway. That's really governors who have a lot of that power over what can open when and in which state. Look, I do think we can't have everything, regardless of kind of risk profile, shut down forever. And trying to figure out what are some areas that people can take sensible risks and reopen some things here or there that, are not really that dangerous for public health, but can be done right with masks and social distancing and all the stuff that we keep hearing about. That said, the idea that you can do that in a one-size-fits-all federal way just doesn't really make sense. We have federalism for a reason. And, letting states figure out, okay, maybe the garden supply places can open up. That's not really a problem. But maybe we want to keep, restaurants and bars closed for longer. Figuring out those choices is immensely difficult. I don't envy any of the public officials having to make these trade-offs. But there, over time, we're going to have to find ways to open certain things in ways that are consistent with avoiding a renewed public health crisis. I'm not sure the president has a clear vision of how to do that. He tends to like to just bang drums and make noise rather than focus on some of those really tough trade-offs and tough details.
Tell me how you're living your own life now.
I'm in a condo in D.C. with my wife and 4-month-old child, and my wife's on maternity leave still. So I'm back here in the office while my little girl is feeding and napping, and it's, you know, she loves it. For the baby, having both parents around all day long is great fun. But I think for us, I would welcome a little more space and a little more chance to get out of the house.
Yeah. Is there anything else regarding the economy that you'd like to say before we close?
Well, I'm an economics writer, so it's my job to look at what's happening to markets and what's happening to the data and that sort of thing. Ultimately, the solution to the economic crisis is a solution to the public health crisis. And ultimately, that's a vaccine. That would also be helped if we develop better treatments for people who do get this disease. Being able to get back to work depends on having kind of testing and tracking systems to enable people to do so safely. So, you know, all this stuff we're talking about on the economy really is second banana to the public health dimension of this. And if we can get that right, then this economy can get back to normal. It just might take a while.
Well, Neil, thank you so much. And I hope you, your wife, and your little baby stay very well.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you. That's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like me to cover during this very difficult time. Please continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening. Please stay safe and stay well. I'm Diane Rehm.